My castaway this week is an entertainer. He's been in front of an audience of one kind or another all of his life. He turned professional at the age of 14 with a one-man routine at the Theatre Royal Bilston. For the next 15 years, he slogged it out as a stand-up comedian and song and dance man until, in 1958, he was chosen as the host of ITV's Sunday Night at the London Palladium. A very British star was born, one who lived on to host the original Generation Game on BBC, perform to packed houses in the West End, and today, at the age of 68, is still on stage, as it were, in ITV's Play Your Cards Right and The Price is Right. "I couldn't be the person people see on the television," he says. "He'd drive me absolutely insane." He is Bruce Forsyth. Is he a monster, Bruce?
Oh, he would. He would. I couldn't be like that all the time. I'm not that...
That what?
I don't know what to call him,
well,
really.
Frenetic.
But he's always there.
He's
in charge. And whenever, just before I go on stage or when I'm going to do a television show, I'm standing on the side there, quite relaxed, probably got a glazed look about my eyes at the time. But then he always turns up and he pushes me on. And then I become this other Brucey.
So he's Brucey as opposed to Bruce, is he?
Oh, yeah, Brucey.
Yeah, Brucey.
Oh, yeah, because he's cheekier.
And he's always there, is he? I mean, do you ever worry that he's not going to be there when you
well,
press that button?
Well, if he doesn't turn up, I'm in terrible trouble. I always do a little step before I walk, and I never noticed that. Then people remarked on it some years ago. I sort of do a little hop before I walk on so that I get my walk going just before I actually appear.
So the walk as well, isn't it?
The walk is all apart. It's his walk. It's his walk. Mind you, I've got a funny walk normally, so it's just an exaggeration of my normal walk.
But he isn't, is he, this performing Brucey?
Yeah.
He isn't the man that you intended, the performer you intended he should be when you first went on stage 55 years ago. I mean, you really intended to be Fred Astaire, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I was going to. Oh, yes, I didn't know you were going to go that far back, Sue.
Oh, it's a long way.
What makes you think I want to go back that far? I mean, just mentioning my age was enough. But no, I wanted to be just the song and dance man. Fred Astaire influenced me.
So dance
greatly.
Was the most important
dance
thing,
was
it?
Just dancing, and I used to dance on our lino at home.
But you sang in public at a very early age, I think, didn't you?
Yes, what you used to do in those days in competitions, you go on and sing a song, like I'd say, sing things like Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones, because it was during the war, you know, it's a big holiday everywhere, and you sing this awful song, and then you'd, after doing the first chorus singing, then you go into your tap dance, and maybe at the end, if you had enough breath left, you'd finish up singing again.
But I'm still going back even earlier than
that. Oh, my goodness.
Because I believe, age three, you stood up in the stalls, didn't you? And sang a song.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was when I was taken to a pantomime at the Streatham Hill Theatre, and the comedian was doing the song sheet at the end of the pantomime, and he asked a question, you know, "Will you all sing with me?" And I shouted out to the man, "Yes, I'll sing with you," and then everybody turned round, and who's that child with the big mouth? And, of course, you know, it stayed with me.
And what
the
did
big
you,
mouth.
What did you sing?
I'm not quite sure, and it was one of these silly pantomime songs of the day. You know, I can't remember that far.
Oh, but you can.
I've never been this far back for years. Bring me one of my pills.
And while that happens, we'll have a first record. Tell me the first record you're going to take to this desert.
Well, it's a gentleman. When people ask me, they say, "Who's your favourite pianist or one of your favourite pianists?" I always say Bill Evans, and people go, "Bill who?" You know, does he play in the pub down the road? No, Bill Evans. I was walking around Soho, and I heard this beautiful piano being played. I walked down into this basement, and there was this man playing the piano. It was something I'll never forget, because from that day on, he influenced me. I try now and again to play a little bit like him, but he has the most wonderful chords, and anybody who loves chords, this is going to be a treat for you. Thank you.
That was Bill Evans playing Emily with Eddie Gomez on bass and Marty Morell on drums. So you were a precocious performer, Bruce. You even ran a dance studio as a little boy, I think.
Oh, yes. Once I'd had a couple of years of tap dancing experience, I thought I could make money out of this. So my father had these garages, these lock-up garages, about 10 of them. And he was always very ambitious for me. He'd never let me go into the garage and get dirty with my hands on it, because he was an engineer, and he never wanted me to go into that business. You know, you keep your hands clean and play the piano or do dance or whatever you want to do. So anyway, I asked him if I could have one of his garages for my dancing studio, and I used to give these little girls lessons, a shilling a time.
And you practiced on the garage roof?
Oh, on the garage roof, I would do that. During the war... with all the fighter planes and the German bombers going over there, I'd go up on the roof to look for bits of shrapnel from the bombs that had been dropped, and then I'd love to get up on that corrugated iron roof and tap dance, because it made more noise.
Yeah, and you put an ad in the Stage saying, I gather, Bruce Forsyth, available for anything, which is a bit dangerous. Right? Did you get any replies?
Yes, it was amazing. See, in those days, it was a different business. You could put an ad in the Stage, the theatre newspaper, and you could get a reply to it, and you could get jobs from it. I mean, and of course, in the war, there again, because so many young men were called up in the army, middle-aged men were called up in the army, you see, you were either too old for the service, or me, for instance, you see, from the age of 14 to when I went into the service, which was 18... You had 4 years there, and there was a shortage. There was a great shortage of male performers. So it was very easy to get jobs, because there were jobs going, and all the theatres were open. I mean, every major city in Britain had about 4 or 5 variety theatres. Mm.
Well,
so there was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Exactly. There was no television. So that was their way of being entertained.
Tell me about your second record.
Oh, second record. Wait a minute. Yes, now, Howard Keel. Howard, I adore him as a person. He's a man's man, but then the way women look at him, you know, he's the kind of guy you think, well, I sum it up, I think, like this, that if my wife was to come to me one day and say, you know, I'm leaving you for Howard Keel, I'd understand. You know, I'd put a hitman on him straight away, but he is the nicest person. And of all the American performers, I think he's probably the most genuine.
I won't send roses or hold the door. I won't remember which dress you wore. My heart is too much in control. The lack of romance in my soul will turn you break it. So stay away.
Howard Keel singing I Won't Send Roses from the musical Mac and Mabel. So let's get you on the Stage, Bruce, on the Theatre Royal Bilston in the Midlands.
My.
Sounds very grand. You were 14 years old.
That's right. I think it was my first professional job.
And what did you look like?
Well, I don't know what I looked like, but I did an act. I was supposed to be a page boy, and I'd bring on a ukulele, banjo, an accordion, and I'd actually bring on a small tap mat, you see. And I'd look inside all these things and play a number on the ukulele. It was the most dreadful act. I was called Boy Bruce the Mighty Atom.
The Mighty Atom?
Yes, I shouldn't have told you that.
How much did you get paid?
Well, at the end of that week, it was such a bad week at this dreadful theatre. And at the end of the week, the business had been so bad, they decided to share it out. You see, like the top of the bill would get so much, and then as your billing went down, you'd get less. And, of course, I was right at the bottom of the bill, Boy Bruce, the Mighty Atom, and I got 13 shillings and fourpence. And I had to phone home to my parents to send me money for my digs and money for my fare home. So that was the end of the most awful week.
But it didn't put you off?
It didn't put me off.
And indeed you went on for the next 15 years, I think, slogging it out.
That's
as
right,
I said,
yes.
In these concert halls of variety around the country. At what point did you develop a kind of interchange with the audience? When did you start talking, picking things up, ad-libbing?
Well, I always had a bit of an interchange with the audience. I mean, when I was doing these amateur shows before I turned pro, and I'd often, you know, if the pianist couldn't play my music at the right tempo, I'd stop and walk over to her and explain to the audience and say, you know, it's a bit quicker, dear, you know.
So you'd have a joke at her expense?
Oh, yes,
just like
I'd break out and talk to the audience. It's always been a thing I've done.
Nevertheless, you were only ever the warm-up man in all those years.
Oh, yes.
That, and they even threw fish and chips at you.
The worst job on Variety was to be the second spot comic, which you always followed the dancing act or the juggler, OK? And your job, don't laugh, Sue, it was terrible. I mean, I had 5 years of that. In fact, I gave myself 5 years. I thought, at the end of this, if I don't do any good in 5 years, I don't want to finish up being a frustrated performer. I'll get out the business. And it was, you know, it was near, the 5 years was nearly up when I got the job at the Palladium. So I was pleased about that. But the fish and chips I got at the Wood Green Empire, as you mentioned it,
since
I don't want people to know that I was fish and chips thrown at me, for goodness sake. Anyway, it was the Saturday night. And what upset me was that the fact that the Wood Green Empire was the nearest Variety Theatre to where I lived in Edmonton, because lots of friends and my mother and father came every night to see me and all that. And on the Saturday night, this whoever it was threw the fish and chips. But I did a pretty good ad lib. I went over to it, sort of opened it out, and sort of took a chip and put it in my mouth and said, oh, no salt and vinegar.
So you got your own back.
I got my own back at the guy. Then he got me a good round of applause.
Record number three.
Ah, Nat King Cole. Well, Nat King Cole probably was the most influence on me learning piano, because before that I played the accordion, the ukulele, banjo, but he influenced me so much, and I had the great thrill of working with him at the Palladium. He happened to come over and they phoned me in the morning and said, Nat's arrived early, Bruce, earlier than we thought. And we thought it'd be nice if you could do a double bit with him. So we worked out a routine in 10 minutes. And then for the rest of the lunch hour, because he knew that I loved his music, he just sat at the piano with nobody else in the Palladium at all and just sat and played just for me alone. It was the most moving thing, and it was something I'll never forget.
It is only a paper moon hanging over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me. It is only a canvas sky sailing over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me.
It's Only a Paper Moon by the Nat King Cole Trio. You must have been, Bruce Forsyth, about 30 when Bruce's big break came, to do Sunday Night at the London Palladium.
Right.
You were a very long shot for them, really. I mean, an inspired one, as it turned out, but you were not at all known.
Yes, well, luckily, Billy Marsh, who was so responsible for that, because Billy happened to come and see the show I did, but then he also saw the Sunday show where I did all audience participation. But the rest of the show in the week was all sketches. So when they were looking for somebody new to do the Palladium, Billy sort of said, well, give this boy a chance. I've been to see him and so. So I was booked really for a month.
But an amazing contrast for you. I mean, from Babbicombe Concert Party.
Exactly. I mean, I was at Eastbourne at the time. I mean, that's the Hippodrome Eastbourne, which was a terrible old theatre. And I'd be working sometimes, even on a Saturday, first houses to about 30 or 40, 50 people. Mm. And two pianos and drums. And then I went from there on the Sunday morning, drove to London, and there I am in the Palladium, 2,500-seater and a 30-piece orchestra, and all the atmosphere that goes with it.
Were you terrified?
I drove round the block three times before I had the courage to go into the stage door.
And you had, obviously, as we know, a great many stars on that show, but, of course, did you realise at the time that it was the beat the clock, it was the audience participation game show that really got us all hooked?
Exactly. And I don't think the people who ran the show really knew that until they took it off about 5-6 years later. They took the show off, or they changed the show and took Beat the Clock out of it, and after that the show was finished.
But it was really the first of the people shows, as they now call them, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Audience involvement on the stage.
Yes, I think the only thing that was on near about that time was Huey Green and W Money.
Yes.
Maybe that was another thing. It was around about that
or
time.
Or Michael Mars, Take Your Pick.
But yes, probably Michael Mars, Take Your Pick. That was probably on at the same time.
But then they were sort of answering questions there, weren't they, Strick? These were people actually participating in
exactly.
things. You were getting them to do games
to
and
do
encouraging.
Games.
I
that's
can
right.
hear you now. So
yes.
that you know, the big clock would stop at 60
that's
seconds
it.
When you
that's
say,
right.
stop,
yeah.
stop, stop,
yeah.
you got it, and
that's
they kept going on,
that's
didn't
it.
They?
It
know?
Was all silly games. It was some wonderful games, actually.
But that's when you started saying, I'm in charge.
Oh, that's
I suppose
right.
you had to be bossy, really.
Yeah, I did have to be bossy. And I'd said it, I mean, just because this woman had carried on, well, she started to do the game before I'd started the clock.
Yes.
You see, and I said, hold on, dear, just a minute, you know. That's what I'm here for. I'm in charge.
Record number four.
Oh, well, this is about the Playdom, actually. Errol Garner, another pianist. Sorry about this, but I do love the piano. Errol Garner worked the Playdom, and I went out to introduce him. And as I went out to introduce him, I looked to the side, because I always looked to Jack Matthews on the side there to see if everything was OK, and he was giving me the sign to stretch, going like this, with his arms about stretched, and I went, oh, fine. So I mumbled and on, and I don't know what I spoke about. Anyway, then all of a sudden he said, right, OK, you can go. I said, oh, fine, ladies and gentlemen, here he is, my favourite pianist, and I know he's yours, Mr Errol Garner. Walked off. I said, what the devil's going on, Jack? What's happening? He said, look at the first piano leg. And there was a beer box there with some black velvet wrapped round it. I said, what? He said, as we were wheeling the piano on, the leg snapped off. We had to then lift it up, get it to the middle, get the beer box and get some black velvet, because it is the Palladium. It couldn't be just a beer box, could it? So there's Errol Garner went, the way go, playing away there on a beer box.
Errol Garner and The Way You Look Tonight, with Leonard Gaskin on bass and Charlie Smith on drums. Now, this catchphrase, Bruce, I'm in charge, wasn't
yes.
entirely random, was it? Because I suspect you're a kind of person who professionally wants to be, needs to be in charge, don't you? Like it done like you like it done.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I'm very... I don't suffer fools. I do like that if I know somebody isn't trying or looks as though they couldn't care less about their work, if I'm doing a show, then I will lose my temper.
But you obviously...
But anybody make mistakes. I make mistakes.
Sure.
You know, fluff a line and, I mean, I've built a whole career on fluffing lines. That's why people go... And I say to people, I don't talk like that. But everybody goes...
They all think you do.
They do, you see.
But you can tell your... scrupulous, as I say, when you were always marking those games in the Generation Game, you always wanted to be very fair. It mattered to you, didn't it, not to misuse people, as it were.
Make very, sure. very important, the marking, and, you know, at times one could get it wrong, and it used to upset me if the markings were wrong, because you know, this is one day in their lives, these people. It's so important to these people. This is why I love everybody to win. I mean, I know everybody can't win, but I'm thrilled
do
when
you?
They're
it matters
do.
To you, does it?
It does, because you see these people and although they say at the end of it, oh, it doesn't matter, we've just enjoyed being here for the day, It still matters to them.
They're very disappointed,
especially
underneath.
In the prizes right now. I mean, they get a chance to win prizes up to about £25,000 at the end of the show. But when they win a car, maybe in the first 5 minutes, this means an awful lot to them. That can influence the rest of their lives.
But you had just as much fun and the programmes were just as successful when you were really not giving much away. I mean, do you think it's all pandered too much to the materialistic approach now?
I agree with you. Just playing for the fun of it is wonderful. And in the 70s, that's how it was. And I think in the 70s, it suited the 70s. But I think we're living in a much more materialistic world now. And I think people do expect to win more. And we expect to give them more as well.
Tell me about your fifth record.
Sammy Davis, yes. Sammy Davis Jr., who to me was the greatest all-round entertainer I've ever seen. I remember once when he worked in Olympia in Paris and I went to see him. And because he was worried about the audience not being able to speak English or understand English, rather, he cut his act really down to the bone.
Look out. One, two, three.
He still talked. But he didn't go on too long in between. It was the greatest performance I think he ever gave.
Yeah. They heard the breeze through the trees singing weird melodies, and they named that just the start of the
Sammy Davis Jr. and Birth of the Blues. So, Bruce, about 10 years after Sunday Night at the London Palladium had finished, The Generation Game was born. I think it was Bill Cotton, head of then Light Entertainment at the BBC.
Yes,
founder,
Bill was the man. I went there with Billy Marsh, who I mentioned earlier on, to see him about doing a talk show, because that's what I wanted to do, you know. But Bill had his own idea. And then he said, I want you to see this tape. And he put this tape on of this lady called Mies Bouwman, who originated the show in Holland. That's where it came from. And I watched this tape for an hour, you see. And he said, well, it's yours if you want to do it. He said, well, so I said, fine. I said, I'd love to do it. I said, I think it's got great possibilities. And then from then on, you know, I was the instigator of doing the plays, and I was also the instigator of doing dance routines where you brought the people in, because it wasn't like that in Holland.
But it was absolutely right for you as a concept.
Yeah, oh, completely
it played
right
to
for
all
me.
Your strengths, yes, that we've talked about that you've been developing, yes, over,
yeah,
all of those years.
Exactly. It was just right for me.
And how would you define the trick with those people? Because it seems to me that the trick is to leave their dignity intact. Have a joke at their expense, but,
yes,
you know, not be rude.
Well, I've always been lucky to be able to semi-insult people and get away with it. Alfred Marx said to me once, he said, if I was to say what you say to people at times, he said, they'd lock me up. Or he said, oh, I'd get a punch in the eye. He said, you do get away with it. I said, yeah, well, it's, I don't know, but they take it from me, and I think they realise in the end, especially with doing the interviews that I used to do, that it was just to relax them.
But you obviously got on their side, as you said. In the end, they were putty in your hands. You could be very rude to them. Was part of the art of doing that to be your own warm-up man?
Yes.
It must be enormously exhausting, because you'd go out there and presumably it could take,
oh,
know,
yes,
3 hours or,
oh,
more,
yeah,
to record a whole Gen,
yes,
game first
a
time
Gen
round.
A Gen game could, and I would be out there practically the whole time, even when we had set changes and everything.
So you still keep talking, still keep the banter
talking,
going.
Keep them going. You'd have a little break maybe now and again, because, I mean, sometimes an audience enjoys having just a couple of minutes to simmer down, you know.
But again, it's part of Brucey being in charge.
Yes,
really,
exactly.
Isn't it? You know, if you're going to do it, you're going to do the whole thing.
Do the whole bit.
And do it as well as,
yes,
you know how.
Yes, a fool to himself.
Record number six.
Right. Now, here's another pianist. This must be the fourth one, isn't it? Somewhere there. Anyway, I love the piano and I love all these guys. I wish I'd have met this man. I never have met George Shearing. It's one of the things that I still live in hope. But this is a beautiful track, and he's backed with the Robert Farnham Orchestra. Thank you.
George Shearing and the Robert Farnon Orchestra and Oh, Lady Be Good from the musical Lady Be Good. We've talked about your peaks, Bruce. Let's talk about your troughs. You bombed in the late 70s on ITV, Bruce's Big Night.
Well, you can say we bombed. And if you were to look in the press cuttings, and it will always be with me till the day I die, that the Big Night bombed. So why did we finish up with an audience of 14 million viewers? We did have a bad start because it was a new show. Every show has teething problems.
It was really you hosting the whole of Saturday night, wasn't it?
Well, it went on for an hour and a half. Yes. It was long, but there were other bits in it. There were 15-minute passages of things.
I mean, whole bits. I think it was an episode of The Huggets in the middle of it.
That's right, yes. Yes.
So you had to come up in between and do a bit of entertainment.
But As I keep getting back to, that we did have a bad first few weeks and the ratings dropped, but then we got them back and got them back. And 14 million viewers in 1978, 79 was pretty big.
But they took it off.
They took it off because I refused to do it anymore, in as much as it was an hour and a half of live television every week, and it was too hard a show to do.
But there were other disappointments after that. I mean, 79 was a bad year for you.
Yes,
it
was.
Your marriage to Anthea broke down.
Yes.
Broke up, ended. And you went off to America, and it didn't quite happen there for you either, did it?
No. Mind you, there again, it was... At one time, there was a very funny thing, because we had the Evening News and the Evening Standard were the two newspapers at the time. One said I'd absolutely bombed out, and the other one said, but a great success. The pity is, it may be looser now, but you see, if you're an actor, you make a film, you can go to America and be successful. If you make a record, or you're a successful group or a successful singer, you can go to America and they'll buy it. But there's no way at the moment, unless it does get easier, for a light entertainment performer to just go there. Mm. It just doesn't happen.
So you didn't make it big in America. You didn't become Britain's answer to Sammy Davis Jr. or Fred Astaire. You became king of the game shows. You are king of the game shows.
Yes, although I still do my one-man show, which there again which I'm doing a few in the next couple of months.
But is it a disappointment to you? I mean, you're brilliant at what you do, but you haven't succeeded in those other things that you do.
I would have much preferred at this stage to have more shows that were light entertainment shows. I do have some lovely specials that I've done over the years, which have always mean a lot to me. But I didn't do a whole batch of series after series
of variety
in the same way
shows
that Morecambe and Wise did and Benny Hill did and all those kind of things, because the game shows, you know, as Bill Cotton said, everybody said, you're too good at game shows, that's your trouble.
So when the relaxed, quiet Bruce sits at home contemplating the career of Brucey, does he sort of think, well, he's done well, but actually he's failed?
Oh, I'll always have a feeling that the other side of what I can do, and I used to do it, and I still could probably do it quite well now, I suppose. But I do feel that it's a shame that that was neglected, and I'll always have that regret. But don't let's burst into tears about it. You know.
Little tear trickling down. Record number seven.
Number seven, yes. Well, as we've got a tear trickling down our cheeks, I never knew you were so sensitive. Good job we're putting this record on. It's by a lovely lady called Dionne Warwick. And when my wife and I, well, Nalia, I was going over to New York to see her, and she was coming over here, working in Paris, and maybe to see her. It was all very romantic, the phone calls and the going here and coming there and all that sort of thing. She was the lady. It was sort of like Our Lady of Song, and Our Lady of Love was Dionne Warwick.
I've kept the memories one by one since you took me in. I know I'll never love this way again. I know I'll never love this way again, so I keep holding on before the good is gone. I know.
Never Love This Way Again, sung by Dionne Warwick. Memories there of courting your wife, Will Nalia, a former Miss World, who is unfailingly reported as being 30 years younger than you. But it's true, isn't it?
It is.
She's younger than one of your daughters.
Uh-huh.
She was Miss Puerto Rico, is that right?
Yes. And is this the Inquisition?
It
now?
Is. And you proposed on bended knee, is that right?
That's right.
And she is Mrs. Scotland. Forsyth, yes. In Wentworth, mm. But in Puerto Rico, you're Mr. World, is that right?
Well, yes. you see, with her being an ex-Miss World, the lovely thing about me going there, you know, 14 years ago was the first time I went there, and the lovely thing is I'm Mr. Nobody. I mean, I'm absolutely Mr. Nobody. So when we got married, you know, I wasn't Bruce Forsyth, the British entertainer and millionaire, whatever they like to say about me. I was Señor Mundo, Mr. World.
And you've taken a lot of stick over the years for the fact that the two of your wives, Will Nalia and Anthea, have been so much younger than you. Has that been difficult to cope with, or do you not?
No, they keep up with me very well. They really do. no, it's. I read somewhere the other day that age is a state of mind, and I think it is right. I mean, I honestly can say, particularly when I sort of go onto an audience and I'm performing in front of an audience, that I don't feel any different to how I did when I was 35, 40 years of age.
You're still as fit as ever.
I feel pretty good, yes.
And you're still as ambitious as ever?
I wouldn't say no. I'm certainly not as ambitious.
Got enough
as ever.
Money, ready to retire?
I could do, but I still like to work. And as long as I like to work, and as long as I don't go on, I'd hate to be over the hill and not know it. If I don't know when to pack it in, I hope those who love me, who are near to me, have the courage to say to me, it's about time to hang up your tap shoes.
Will they dare? Do you think?
Oh, I think they would. I think they would. Yes.
Last record.
Here's a man who, there again, I grew up with. The arrangement, the Nelson Riddle arrangements, will never be bettered. One of the greatest singers of all time, for me personally, is Frank Sinatra.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin.
Frank Sinatra with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra singing Cole Porter's I've Got You Under My Skin. If you could only take one of those records, Bruce, which one would it be?
Bill Evans, How Cute, Paper Neck and Cole.
You've got to choose one.
Yeah, there's not one of mine there.
This is true.
Oh, well, I'd sling one of these out then. I'd get rid of one of these.
You can't do that at this stage.
No, I've got to. You've got to put My Little Budgie. That was one of my biggest hits. Well, I suppose with My Darling, Will Nalia, and it was the most romantic time in my life. I'll Never Love This Way Again.
Dionne Warwick.
It's got to be that one.
What about a book?
Because otherwise we'll get no supper tonight. What's that?
A book. You've got the Bible and
Shakespeare. Oh, a book. Yes. I'm going to surprise you now. I think the works of Omar Khayyam, because I'd love to learn those. Because I was you know, thinking about this, and I love all the court dramas by John Grisham. I've read every one of those, and I love them. But because once you've got the story, that's it. But Omar Khayyam, I'd love to learn. Like, I did learn one years ago, Awake, O Morning, on the Bowl of Night, has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight. And lo, the hunter of the east has caught the sultan's turret in a noose of light.
And that was Bruce, not Bruce.
There you are. It was Bruce. Well, that surprised you, didn't it?
Did.
Get off the floor, Sue, for goodness sake.
And your luxury.
Oh, my luxury? Oh, yes, my sand iron. Because it's the one part of golf that always... I'm not good out of bunkers unless I practice. So depending on how long I was, I'd have to have at least two or three balls as well to take with me. Is that allowed?
That's allowed,
fine.
Yeah.
And when I left that island, I'd be as good a bunker player as Gary Player. I mean, I'd really... That would be very important to me.
Bruce Forsyth, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Sue.